STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Hello, friends. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason. Over 2 decades of listening to that chicken, and it still makes me chuckle. Actually, the chicken's not a chicken. It's me pretending to be a chicken. This goes back a long time, and somewhere on the internet, I guess, on our website, you can get some information of the background of that cock-a-doodle-doo. But I am nearly giddy with excitement about a trip that's coming up for me. Today is Tuesday, and Thursday night sometime, either late Thursday evening or around midnight or early Friday morning, I will be leaving Los Angeles with my brother Dave on a road trip to take my 283,000-mile Tahoe to Wisconsin on a 40-hour trip drive, and of course, I'm not looking forward to being totally worn out, but I think it's going to be fun with my brother Dave. He's my fishing partner, and we hang out a lot together when we're able. Actually, I was thinking about it. It feels like we hang out a lot together because I talk to him a lot, and it seems like every time I call him, he's listening to me on the radio show, so maybe he's listening as I'm speaking right now. In any event, he's a lot of fun to be with, and I haven't actually seen him for about 3 years. But we are going to spend 2 full days on the road and then 2 full weeks in Wisconsin fishing, and the ice is out. It's been out for a month. The snow seems to be gone. The bass are stirring, thinking of love, moving into the shallows for their annual spawn. But they got to fatten up before they go on a honeymoon. So that's when we'll be there ready to feed them our artificial offerings and enjoy some early season bass fishing, smallmouth bass in this case. Anyway, it's just on my mind, and I've had so many things to do. I've had to buy a new car since I'm driving my old car up there and leaving it there at the cabin. It'll be my new tow vehicle, and getting it all cleaned up tomorrow, and just had new tires put on it and had rear differential fixed and everything. So it's in tip-top shape. I said it's got 280-some-thousand miles on it. I figure I might get another 15 or 20 out of it before it dies a natural death. And I figure if I get that much out of it, it'll last me at least 10 years in Wisconsin. So I'm going to take it up there, and I've ordered a new vehicle, which is being delivered tomorrow. Yes, a Tahoe, another Tahoe. I love them. This is my, well, it's my, let's see, one, two, it's my second Tahoe, but it would be my third Chevy SUV. I had 2 Blazers before that, so I'm sold on these vehicles. And I keep them oiled up really well, and all the fluids changed, and take care of them, and they seem to run forever. So I'm happy with that, hoping for this new vehicle to last me another 13 years like the last one, that 2002, that'll be driving out in a couple of days. Anyway, so I've got my attention split here a little bit, but speaking of driving, a couple of bumper stickers caught my attention here the other day, and here is one of them. Save the planet, kill yourself. How about that? Now, I know what you are probably thinking right now, the same thing I thought when I first saw that. Save the planet, kill yourself. I thought, gee, why doesn't the person driving the car follow his own advice? Now, of course, I don't want them to kill themselves, but it strikes me if they're so concerned about the planet that they think, even jokingly, some should die, then maybe they should put themselves at the top of the list. Of course, this is a guy driving one of those very small green-type cars, probably an electric thing, and there it was. I'm always a bit mystified by bumper stickers like that or even the philosophy like that. Now, you might be thinking, don't you care about the planet? Well, I do, but my caring about the planet makes perfect sense in light of my worldview, because I think the obligation to be careful about our environment is not out of love for the planet or respect for nature, but out of love for God and love for my neighbor. And that, it seems to me, is the only rationale from which it makes sense to have an obligation to care for the planet. Because if the planet is just all there is, in other words, if materialism, naturalism, physicalism is the real name of the game, and we're that's all it is molecules clashing in the universe, I don't see how there can be any obligation to any aggregation of molecules whatsoever, whether it be to persons or to planets, for that matter, because just reorganizing molecules, it seems, cannot cause a moral obligation to pop into the air, into the immaterial realm, in a way that it has incumbency upon certain aggregations of atoms in that larger world, the human aggregation of atoms. It seems to me, on that viewpoint, we are just all molecules in motion, and some might be more complex than others, and you can talk about greater or lesser in that regard, but I don't know how it makes any sense to talk about greater or lesser value of anything if that's your point of view. And I'm not even sure what it means to save the planet. And I want you to think about that for a moment, because this kind of language is so common in our collective parlance here that we take it for granted that, you know, if we pollute all of our waterways, that somehow we're destroying the planet. But what does it actually mean to destroy something? It means to corrupt it from its original purpose, doesn't it? If you break something, that means it's not doing what it was supposed to do. But on a naturalistic view of the universe, there is no supposed to do, because there's no supposer. And if there's no supposed to do, then there's no way to break anything. You can change the circumstances, but I don't see how it makes sense to say that something then gets broken. And if a thing can't be broken, it can't be imperiled, because to say it's imperiled is just another way to say that it could be broken. And if it can't be imperiled, then it can't be saved. So the whole notion of saving the planet is tied to some of necessity, to some form of teleology or purpose for the universe. Of course, atheist types are going to deny transcendent purpose, but they're going to say, well, that's fine because I have my own individual purpose, and that's adequate for me, and I understand that. But then it doesn't make any sense to say that one needs to save the planet unless all you mean is save it for you, save it for your individual purposes. You can only save a big thing if there's a big purpose for that big thing. And if there is no purpose, sir, then there's no purpose, and then it can't be lost because it cannot be corrupted for its whatever it was intended for, and therefore it cannot be saved. So every time you see one of these kind of save the planet type bumper stickers or whatever, you might think about that and might be useful just to ask a few questions of the person sporting the bumper sticker and see how they can make sense of their sticker. Now, the slogan on the sticker. Now, I understand that to question the notion that we ought to save the planet is bizarre, because the responsibility we have regarding the planet seems to be completely self-evident. Now, I do agree with that. I do think that there is a built-in sense that we have some responsibility here, and how that cashes out, which species we save, et cetera, is a different issue. But just the broader question of the obligation we have regarding our the environment we live in, that I think there's truth to that, and I think everybody knows it. But you see, atheism, naturalism, materialism, physicalism has no ability to make sense of that. Those views have no explanatory power with regards to this deep-seated conviction we have that there's a certain stewardship required of us. And this is one of the reasons I don't believe those views, because the conviction seems well-grounded, but those views don't make sense of it. Now, if it turns out that we live in a world that has been entrusted to us, that is, that has been handed over to us to care for in some sense, for our purposes, and then boy, that intuition matches this other notion. Oh, I get it. That's why. That's a fit, right? But you see, that's the Christian worldview. Be fruitful, multiply, subdue the earth. Because in that case, we have responsibility, but the responsibility is to God in light of his purpose for the earth, which is to be a place for us, a home for us. And in that regard, then, we are not the plague on the planet such that we want to save the planet, we have to kill us. No, we're the reason for the planet. This is our home. This was given to us to use in a beneficial way for our well-being. And that's why, for example, in Central California, when you have a drought in the Central Valley, you don't hold back the water so some fish could drink it, especially a little bitty minnow, when humans need it, because it's not for the minnow. It's for us, because the minnow is for us too. All of those things are for us because we are not on equal footing with all the created creatures. We are above them. Incidentally, that should not be a surprising notion, because most of us have this sense, and even those who deny it in a certain fashion act like it's true. This is that point of tension where they implicitly affirm certain details of our worldview. Save the planet, kill yourself. Doesn't that imply that human beings are the plague and they should be gotten rid of? But what about locusts? They, you know, eat more than their fair share sometimes. Well, they're natural, so that doesn't count. They're where they're supposed to be. Well, notice that in that way of characterizing it, humans have a unique role then. In this case, it's put pejoratively, but we are not simply natural like everything else is natural. We are, in a certain sense, non-natural. You could say unnatural, I guess, but non-natural. We are different from everything else in a very profound way. And, of course, some people want to say, yeah, that's a bad thing. That's why we should get rid of humans. But the difference is the thing I'm pointing to, that they are already aware of. It is informing their comments, but it makes no sense on their worldview. It makes sense in our worldview. So there's, once again, and I've played this theme quite a few times in the last few weeks because I think it's a good one. There is explanatory power in the Christian worldview. And a view's explanatory power is a key to its it being claimed to be true. If your view explains the way the world actually is in meaningful ways, then, boy, that's a plus for your view, isn't it? So let's see. This whole notion of there is an optimal way that nature should be, and we must work for that, and if it's not moving that way, then nature is imperiled and we have to save the planet. All of that is language that is teleological, which only makes sense if there is a telos, that is an end, a purpose to things. In a naturalistic world, there are no ends. There are no purposes. Things aren't made for. There is no way it's supposed to be, so then the notion of saving it turns out to be vacuous. The other bumper sticker that I saw here was Jesus was a liberal. Now, this is a notion that I've had to deal with before in actually, a number of years ago, I was on a radio show with Alan Combs. It was Alan's radio show, and many of you know Alan Combs as the erstwhile liberal partner of the Hannity and Combs duo on Fox News, and Hannity the conservative and Alan Combs the liberal. I think Combs is still on Fox. I don't watch that, but every once in a while I see him in the airport. It's been off as a duo for a long time, I know, but a lot of people, yeah, but he's still on, just getting some clarification from the enforcer there. So he's still around, but a number of years ago, I was invited to be on his radio show because he had written a book on liberalism, and he had a chapter in there that was titled, like this bumper sticker, Jesus Was a Liberal. And he wanted someone to weigh in on the other side. Now, I wasn't so interested in the political conversation, but I was interested in talking about Jesus, especially with Alan Combs on Alan Combs' own network, which I presume was a high target area for the kinds of things that I like to talk about. And so I was glad to be on. And it turns out I was on for over an hour. They kept me on over the top of the hour, which is when you usually change topics to something else, but he was enjoying himself enough that he wanted to have me on for a little bit longer. I was enjoying myself too, because I felt like I was making a contribution, and I was glad to talk about Jesus. And of course, one thing I said that once you start talking about Jesus and quoting Bible verses, you may end up encouraging people to actually go and read the text for themselves. Now, I'm just going to tell you something, friends. If you see somebody who is sporting a bumper sticker that says Jesus was a liberal, I'm just going to tell you right now, you're seeing a car driven by somebody who has not read Jesus. When you think of the full range of kind of liberal causes, and if you want to speak very, very generally and say, well, liberals care for the poor, but of course that's not distinctive of liberals, so do conservatives. And Jesus cared for the poor, which is true, although, so if you want to say, well, Jesus was a liberal in that regard, well, it wasn't exactly his main suit. That is, it wasn't the main reason he came, even though he did talk a bit about that. And I can say it wasn't the main reason he came, and because the final gospel, the penultimate example of Jesus' life, the Gospel of John, one of Jesus' closest friends, when he writes the final testament, if you will, the final summary of the life of Jesus of Nazareth, never mentions anything that could be remotely associated with social justice even a single time. Nothing in that gospel. The only reference to the poor is when Jesus says, somewhat dismissively, in light of what was going on at the time, the poor you always have with you. So if you look at all of the peculiar, and I mean particular and unique, causes of the liberal left, it's going to be very difficult to find Jesus weighing in support of those things at all. But there is this common misunderstanding that what Jesus was all about was liberating the poor people. And in fact, Alan Combs' citation of, was it Luke 4 or Matthew 4, wherever, where Jesus says, I came to liberate, the passage, he drew that out, liberate, liberal. Yeah, that was his argument. and he overturned the tables of the money changers, and therefore he is against capitalism, so there's another liberal characteristic of Jesus, etc. So I hope people who think that Jesus was a liberal will take the time at least to read him for themselves and from the beginning. And I think they will discover that there is very little in the teaching and the life of Jesus of Nazareth himself that could be pressed into service when taken in context in favor of the particulars of a more liberal leftist political agenda. Now, it is interesting, though. So this is actually an exercise in misinformation, and not that they are trying to promote the misinformation. I think they are just simply misinformed. Read Jesus. Read Jesus for yourself. And I've been doing it for 40 years. And one comes up with an entirely different picture of what his purposes were than what a liberal agenda would reflect. However, it is interesting that people from any perspective like that would be citing Jesus at all, because that crowd is not particularly religious and sometimes disdainful of religion. And there are exceptions to this, of course. However, characteristically, these are not the people that are you're going to see in church every Sunday and promoting biblical causes, okay? But it does identify something interesting. Why is it that they want to quote Jesus at all? Doesn't the appeal to Jesus suggest they believe Jesus is someone to be contended with? It's like the person who says, well, Jesus never said anything about homosexuality. Well, that's not precisely true, but let's just take it at face value. Why should it matter? It's a fair question. Why should it matter what Jesus said at all? Now, I can see a Christian raising that issue, because to the Christian, it matters what Jesus says because they're a follower of Jesus, and he's a guide on for them. He's a guide for their moral decision-making. But for someone who's not a Christian, why would they cite Jesus? Why should it matter? And of course, it's an almost explicit acknowledgement that Jesus is someone to contend with. He's a player. He's somebody who's got fabulous credentials. And if you can get Jesus on your side, oh man, that's great. And so that's why people make this comment. Jesus wasn't against homosexuality, and if he wasn't against homosexuality, or never spoke against it, implication being if he didn't speak against it, then he was not against it. Now, this would be a logical misstep, of course, but we'll just carry it through. He was not against it, and if he's not against it, then I got Jesus on my side, they think, and if I got Jesus on my side in favor of homosexuality, then boy, he's a heavy hitter. He's my ringer, okay? So I just want to acknowledge that these kinds of statements, whether regarding homosexuality or liberalism, all bear testimony to the fact that Jesus is someone to be contended with. And I agree with that, and my thought is, well, if he is really somebody to be contended with, then maybe we shouldn't be concerned simply what he did or didn't say about homosexuality, but I should put it this way. We shouldn't be so concerned with what he didn't say about homosexuality as we are with what he did say about a host of other things. If he's a player, if he's a contender, if he's a ringer, if he's the guy that we should take seriously, the guy we want on our team. But of course, you know, that's not human nature. People are just picking and choosing when it suits them. And when Jesus doesn't support their view, then they don't want to hear from him. Anyway, just a thought. To your calls in just a moment. I'm Greg Kokel with Stand to Reason.
There's always something new for you on the STR.org homepage, where you'll find sound analysis and careful commentary on the issues challenging Christians today. Along with new articles each month from Greg, Brett, and Alan, you'll also find new blog posts every day, new podcasts and featured articles each week, a new featured resource each month, and updated news about local and online events. So take a few moments to browse the STR.org homepage and see what's new today. And keep coming back to stay informed and encouraged as you grow as a Christian ambassador. Stop by today and every day at STR.org.
It's hard to keep in mind all the facts and arguments you need to address tough topics. That's why STR has developed a series of quick reference guides on same-sex marriage, abortion, and tactics to help refresh your memory and encourage dialogue. These guides give you concise answers, all on a single 8.5x11 inch laminated card. They're a quick and easy way to gain useful knowledge about some of the most important issues facing Christians today. With these tools at your side to guide your thoughts and aid your memory, you'll engage critics with full confidence. You'll be fully equipped to answer objections with grace and clarity. Get your quick reference guides today by visiting the STR store at store.str.org or calling 800-2-REASON.
Greg Kokel back at you here at Stand to Reason. I was just thinking, in light of this Save the Planet business, New York Times ran an article just following Mother's Day, which was last weekend, 2 days ago. And the article was about how, in their opinion, flowers might be nice for mom on Mother's Day, but they're not nice to planet Earth. Because this is where we cut off the reproductive organs of the plant so the plant can't reproduce again, and that inhibits the purpose of Mother Nature or something to that effect. And it did occur to me, you know, all those flowers that people bought for their mother on Mother's Day, and in our family there were 24 roses, one set of red and one set of pink, to honor my daughter's mother, my wife. All of those were commercially grown. So they will happily be replaced. Those plants are just doing fine with Mother Nature. In fact, they were planted for the purpose of making the flowers. And had that not been the purpose, those plants would probably not have been planted to begin with. So flowers on Mother's Day actually create more plants. And that ought to help planet Earth, right? Not hurt us. And all of those plants so assaulted with the removal of their flowers will be happily replaced due to capitalism. So no worries there. Oh, boy, let's go to Maine and talk with our friend JJ. Hey, JJ, welcome to the show. Welcome back, I should say.
Hello, Mr. Kokel.
I'm actually looking at your picture.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's your Christmas card from, gee, I wonder if this was the year before last. Oh, wait a minute. It says here, from the Blackmans, 2013. So that was, a little more than a year ago now. 2014, yeah, a year and a half. And your voice, is, every time you call, your voice is different. It's amazing. So how tall are you now, JJ?
Oh, I'm like 5'5".
5'5". And you're how old now?
15.
15. And you have been calling probably for the last, you and your brother, for how long would you say? Five years?
Probably 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
Something like that. Maybe 4 years, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, it's great to hear from you again, and my best to your whole family. I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 children.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes, and to your folks as well. So what's on your mind today, JJ?
Well, some Jehovah's Witness came to our door about a month ago, and we talked about, you know, if Jesus was God and about the common verses like John 1:3.
Yeah.
But they offered an argument against that Jesus was God, and I'll try to explain it, but I don't know if I understand it too well, and
okay.
I might be missing something.
All right.
So their argument was something like Adam was a perfect man and he sinned. And if Jesus was God and he was punished, it would outweigh a man. So God would be punished for a man's sin. And the Jehovah's Witness was saying that they wouldn't balance each other out. God doesn't balance with a man. So I was just wondering if you've heard that objection before and had
an
answer to it.
I'm not surprised that you're a bit confused, because I'm confused too. I'm not exactly sure the force of this or the point.
Well, I might be missing something they said, because I didn't, you know, write it down or take notes from them or anything.
So I'm trying to give it the best spin. Adam was a perfect man.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, of course, that phrase itself needs qualification. He was a perfect man in that when God created him, he was everything that God intended him to be.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, he was perfect, although some people want to read into the notion of perfection the concept of immutability. That means if Adam could sin, then that means he wasn't perfect. That's like saying a pen isn't a perfect pen if the pen could break at some point. Now, it seems to me that a pen is a perfect pen as long as the pen does just what the maker of the pen intended of it, not that the pen could continue to perform unto infinity like that without any alteration. So I'm perfectly comfortable with saying that Adam is the perfect man as long as there's no suggestion that perfection requires immutability. That means that no possibility for change. This is why some people say, well, if he is perfect, how could he sin? Because his perfection did not entail the notion that he couldn't become less than perfect morally. So I think Adam was the perfect man because he was just so when God made him. However, in view of his freedom, he was fallen. He became fallen. And then this created a guilt load or a debt load on him that needed payment. Now, okay, so that's the first thing they said. I'm okay with that, properly qualified. But then they said, Jesus, who is the second Adam, according to Romans 5, could not be God because, and here's where I'm lost, somehow related to it's an uneven payment.
Yeah, it was something along those lines. Like the punishment doesn't fit the crime or something like that.
Well, I don't, even if there's some question about the punishment fitting the crime, I don't understand how that has any relation, bears any relationship to the deity of Christ. There's a number of ways I can go with this, and all I can do, since I'm not entirely sure what they meant, is to try to build a little bit from the bottom. So here God makes man in this just right relationship with him, also in possession of moral freedom, which means man can choose to rebel against his sovereign, which he does. And so when he does, something terrible happens, everything breaks. And man becomes not only broken, but guilty. Okay, now what? God is angry because of what man has done. So then God sets up a rescue operation. Okay, now how is man going to be rescued? God is just, and so he's got to have a payment for the rebellion. And since it is man who rebelled, then man has to pay. And individual men will pay for their own crimes unless they benefit from the mercy that God offers. But the plan that God offers is to become a man himself and as a man take the punishment for men, though he, now Jesus, himself did not deserve the punishment because he alone was one who had done good and never bad. So I guess one could say, well, that's not fair, which is true. It's not fair to Jesus, but Jesus was willing to take the punishment that was due us on himself so that mercy could be expressed even though justice was accomplished. Okay, now this is a message that you're deeply familiar with, but I'm just kind of spelling it out, and I'm trying to think, where is the inconsistency that would offend a Jehovah's Witness, specifically as it touches the question of the deity of Christ. And why one of the reasons I think the atonement is evidence for the deity of Christ is because it is described as an act of love by God. So the famous verse in John 3, you know this one, for God.
Oh, yeah.
For God what?
Let's see, just slipped
3:16.
My mind right now. Let's see.
For God so loved.
Oh, yeah, okay. For God so loved the world that he gave his only son.
Yes.
That whoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life.
Right, so the...
I thought you meant John 1:3.
Oh, yeah, I see. Yeah, right. So, no, I'm back in a more general phrase about the forgiveness, and I am sure that your friends, your Jehovah's Witnesses friends, understand, and they know this verse, and they understand it's at least its general significance. Yes, it's an act of love that God expressed by giving a son. I mean, they believe the Bible, by and large, I mean, they have some odd translation in their own Bible, but they're committed to the Bible. So, but here's the point I'm getting to, and this is what a lot of people have not thought about. It said that God loved by giving. So when he gave up Jesus, of course, Jesus is lifted up on the cross and punished on the cross. But so the Father gives his Son and beats up his Son on behalf of us so that we will be forgiven, and this is an act of the Father's love. Well, wait a minute. JJ, your brother's name is?
Josh.
Josh, yeah. So let's just say Josh was really bad, and to me, and I said, Josh, I love you so much that instead of beating you up, I'm going to beat up JJ. Mm-hmm. Well, that might be an example, JJ, of your love for Josh, if you told me, no, let me take the punishment on myself. But how is an example of my love for Josh that I beat JJ up? Do you see that?
That's a good way.
Yeah.
I've heard you talk about this before.
Yeah, well, you see the problem there, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Now, but if it turns out, let's get back to God now, if it turns out that God beats up Jesus and Jesus is God, then it is an example of God's love because God is taking the punishment on himself. And actually, it goes way beyond that because in order to take the punishment on himself, he has to condescend, step down to be a man. And this is what Paul was talking about in Philippians chapter 2. Have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus, that though he existed in the form of God, he did not regard equality with God a thing to be held on to, but rather he humbled himself to become a man. So we have God humbling himself, taking on the form of a man. That's a price to pay. And then he took on the form of a servant. That's a further price to pay. And then he died the death of a common criminal on our behalf. That's a further price to pay, all that God did. So that if Jesus wasn't God, then it's hard to see how anything that happened on the cross regarding salvation was an example of God's love for us.
Yeah, they might be coming back soon, so I'll have to ask them about this.
Yeah, well,
see
good.
What they say.
Yeah, I think that is a very, very fair point. You might even, if you wanted to do a Columbo style, you could ask them, was the cross an example of God, of the love of God?
Mm-hmm.
And if they balk at that, you say, wait, here in John 3:16, what is the most famous verse in all the Bible? And then they could cite it for, oh, yes, the cross was a sign of God's love. Now, they may have a different understanding of how the cross worked out, but it was a sign of his love. And then I think it's fair to raise the question, how is it a sign of God's love?
Yeah.
Well, if God didn't pay any price for this, how is it a sign of his love? And see what happens. I don't, you know, going through that kind of foundational look at the work of the cross and what Jesus did and God's gift to us in Christ, I do not see how they can construct a kind of a complaint that somehow this is unequal or whatever. I mean, certainly it is in a certain sense unfair. Jesus got what he didn't deserve, so we can get what we didn't deserve. But that's a virtue of the system. He got our punishment. We get his righteousness. That's 2 Corinthians 5:21. He made him who knew no sin to be sin in our behalf, that we might become the righteousness of God in him. So that's a virtue of the cross, that lack of equality. That's the point. No, we aren't getting what we deserve. We deserve justice, not mercy. Jesus took justice so we can get mercy on his behalf and in his name. So I don't know what else they could be complaining about.
Yeah, okay.
Okay? JJ?
Yeah, okay.
It's a pleasure talking to you. And by the way, fishing season's on us.
Oh, yeah, it is.
Have you been out yet?
Yeah, we went out one time, but we didn't catch anything.
Are you in your canoe?
Yep.
Yeah, well, Maine has some great smallmouth fishing, you know that.
Oh, yeah.
And how long's the ice been out there?
Probably since April 25th.
Okay, well, so that's
April 20th.
20th. So that's just 4 weeks, all right? When the water temps get up in the mid-50s, like 54, 55, those smallmouth are going to be moving more into the shoreline, into the points and the gravel and the rocks and stuff like that. That's when you want to start throwing your baits up there and looking for those fish.
Yeah, it's probably right up there right now.
Yep, that's right.
57, 58.
Wow, that is getting warm. So see if your dad will take you out in the boat, you know, in the next couple days or whatever, and get some of that early season smallmouth action, okay?
Yep, I hope you have good luck up in Wisconsin.
Well, thanks a lot, JJ. I'm looking forward to it. I'm really, really jazzed. So we'll see. Call me back. Well, I'll probably talk about it on the show when I get back first weekend of June.
Okay. Well,
all right,
thank you
buddy.
Very much for answering my question.
Yes, you're welcome, and all the best to your whole family.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, JJ, that is Mr. JJ from Maine, and he's been on board with us since he was like 10 or maybe even younger, so it's great talking to him again. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more of your calls on Stand to Reason.
Carry STR with you by downloading our Stand to Reason and Quick Reference apps for free. Both are available for iPhone, iPad, and Android. From your STR app, listen to the weekly podcast, speaker podcasts, check out the STR blog, Access Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letters, and more. The Quick Reference app gives you the tools you need to answer the toughest questions Christians face, all through the easy-to-read text and short videos. You'll have STR resources at your fingertips in a clean layout with great features and functionality. And they're free, so download the apps today and start carrying STR with you everywhere you go.
Would you like Greg, Brett, or Alan to come and speak at a location near you? Find out how you can invite them to your area by visiting the speaker section at str.org. Our speakers are accomplished and compelling presenters who address from a biblical standpoint topics like abortion, homosexuality, and evolution, as well as apologetics, theology, and evangelism. They're available to teach lectures and seminars, preach sermons, and lead workshops at single events or weekend-long conferences. Their aim is to help Christians like you effectively engage the culture around you with knowledge, wisdom, and character. To schedule Greg, Brett, or Alan today, send an email to Melinda or Danielle. To learn more, visit str.org/training/speakers.
Greg Kokel back at you here on Stand to Reason, taking your questions, your calls, your comments, 855-243-9975. Don't give that number very often, but there it is. So if you want to call and talk with me, you're welcome to do so. You have to do it during the live show, which is Tuesday nights from 4 until 7 Los Angeles time. Let's see, David in San Diego, let's go to him. Welcome to the show, David.
Hey, Greg, how's it going?
I'm doing fine. Glad you called.
Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
So a couple months ago, probably back in November, I finished up reading Tactics.
Good.
And there's some great questions in there for engaging non-believers and just having live conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But lately, when I've been reading the Bible, I've been having a hard time asking myself questions that enhance my study of the Bible. So I was wondering if you have any questions that you ask yourself to try to get as much information out of a passage as possible.
Yeah, there's one main question that I ask. I probably should be asking more. So I'll talk about that in a moment. But the most important question that you can ask when you go to the Scripture is this one. What is the author communicating? What does the author intend me to understand from the text is another way of putting it. What is the author trying to tell me here? So this means that the meaning of a text is grounded in what's called authorial intent, the intention of the author. And this is a common sense notion. I mean, when we're talking with somebody and maybe we're having a disagreement about something and they cite us on something and we would say, wait a minute, you're twisting my words. That's not what I meant. You're distorting my concept or something like that. Mm-hmm. We are objecting because what they ought to be tuning into is our meaning when we said that, rather than twisting or distorting what our meaning is and misrepresenting us. We care about others getting us right, even if they disagree with us, fine. But let's, you know, first let's get it right. And then we can have talk about, you know, if we differ or not. Well, the same thing is true of the biblical authors. These people are writing for a reason. They have an intention. They hope to communicate something in particular. And so it is our job then to figure out what that is, unless we just don't care. I mean, it might be we don't care, and we don't care what God's purposes are. But people who are Christians going to the book, or anyone going to the book, presumably are trying to figure out what the author has in mind, because the authors, even if they aren't, you know, even if the reader doesn't have a high view of Scripture, it seems that they're acknowledging that the author has some kind of insight and they're there to get it. They're not there just to read the lines and make up their own meaning. So that's what I would say would be the most important question. And in fact, no other questions matter until you've answered that one. Does that make sense to you?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, I've been reading in Tim Keller's book on prayer lately, which is a book that I highly recommend. And it sounds like you're in a parking lot somewhere, or are you driving?
No, that's my phone vibrating.
Oh, okay, I got it. It sounded like a car honking. It still sounds like a car honking, but does that mean somebody's calling in?
Someone's texting me while I'm calling you.
I got you. Okay.
My phone's buzzing.
All right, got it. Okay. One of the things that you find in this fine book by Tim Keller is an analysis of the way different saints in the past have prayed, and he does not distinguish prayer. He does not isolate prayer from Bible study. That is,
what's the title of that book?
It's called Prayer.
Oh,
isn't that it, Melinda? Yeah, Tim Keller, and the book is just simply called Prayer. So,
straightforward.
Yeah, right. Easy to remember. So he does not isolate prayer from Bible study. Okay, that is it. Prayer should be grounded in God's Word. And he talks a lot about this and about how people like Calvin and Luther and Augustine and a whole bunch of other folk have used the Bible as a foundation for guiding their own prayer life. Now, to do that most effectively, there are questions that different ancients have suggested we ask when we go to the Bible. There are patterns like adoration, confession, thanksgiving, and supplication. That would be a pattern for prayer, ACTS. But there are also patterns of questions that you can ask when you go to the text. And some ancient believers held that you shouldn't even start praying until you spend time reading in Scripture, because what Scripture does is inform you of God's perspective. It realigns you with reality, so to speak, so that when you begin to address God in prayer, your mind has already been warmed up a little bit with God's perspective. And in order to do that, it isn't just reading through the text surreptitiously. Okay, I'm going to read a bunch of verses now. Here's a couple of Proverbs, some Psalms, and okay, now I'm ready. But rather to read in a probing way of the text, asking certain questions. For example, is there a behavior that I should avoid? Is there a virtue that I should develop? Is there something about God and his person and his character that I need to understand? So these would be examples of questions you might ask when you're reading through the text. So you're reading Sermon on the Mount, for example, and and you're asking what you're asking questions like, what does this tell me about God, or what does this tell me about Jesus, or what does this tell me about my behavior, or about the way I ought to be thinking? So those would be examples of questions that you can ask yourself over and above that initial question that I identified, that most critical question, what is the author intending to convey? And this is what allows you to get to the basic meaning of the text. Once you've got the meaning, well, then you could start drilling down a little deeper and seeing how that applies in different areas in your life, whether this is something about God that you need to understand, whether this is something about your behaviors that you need to attend to, or your attitudes or something like that. And in Keller's book, he goes into those in some detail, talking a lot about particular ancients who we look up to as great men of God and exactly how their Bible study and their prayer were woven together. So, does that give you some help there?
Yes, it does. I'll have to get Keller's book. That sounds really good. I've been meaning to read some stuff of his, but I'm buying more books faster than I can read them.
I know how that works.
Yeah.
I got an added problem. People send me books for free. Just think of that. They pile up. So
can pile up quickly.
Yeah, this one's worth it. I think that Phil Yancey? Yeah, Phil Yancey's book on prayer is also really good. It's a very thick book, and it is not triumphalist at all. It's the good, the bad, and the ugly about prayer. And I find that that's encouraging and helpful for me because prayer is somewhat enigmatic. How exactly does prayer work? How do we do it effectively? And so he's got a lot of different angles that he pursues that I think are helpful. That's Philip Yancey's book. I think that's also titled Prayer or something like it. Something like that, just a simple prayer.
Okay.
As a title. But Keller, I was actually quite surprised when I began reading the book. It was recommended to me by Melinda Penner, the enforcer here, and I don't know, she might have even bought it for me. It's better than I thought it would be. Now, I probably should qualify that because I have very high regard for Tim Keller, and I listen to him and his sermons and podcasts, and he feeds my soul. There's no question there. But some things that he talks about spiritually are just beyond me. I can't really sink my teeth into them. And I was thinking that maybe his treatment of prayer I was going to find it too spiritual for me. I mean, to put it bluntly. And I found that the way he's approaching prayer and the way he divides the book up, I find very satisfying and very helpful. And I like the fact that he is drawing from the ancients so much. And he purposefully decided not to read a lot of modern books on prayer because he wanted to draw from the wisdom of the ages. And this is why he goes back to John Owen, for example, the great Puritan, and others like him, or Calvin, or Martin Luther, or even Augustine, I think he cites. So there, and some of the mystics of the past to see exactly how they conducted their prayer along with the Bible. And the reason that prayer came up here, since your question was on the Bible, is that, as Keller's characterizing it, you don't separate the two. So you're asking questions of the Bible to inform yourself about God's way so that when you launch into prayer, you are praying in a way that's consistent with his understanding of the world. So I could recommend that book strongly.
All right, I'll definitely look into that.
All right, Dave?
All right.
All right, I appreciate the call.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, you're welcome. All the best to you. And it might surprise you a little bit that I put it that way, that I was surprised with Keller's book. It just was more, I was pleasantly surprised, let's put it that way. And like I said, I have the high regard for him. But sometimes listening to his sermons, I get a little bit I don't know, lost is the right word, but it just, there's some things that are too wonderful for me, let me put it that way. But I found that his book on prayer was exceptionally practical, at least as far as I've read it. And I've actually bounced around a couple of places, read here and there, and then started at the beginning and then jumped around a little bit more too. So I'm kind of working my way through it, but also jumping ahead at some spots, looking for stuff that piqued my curiosity and catch my interest right then. And I find for myself that usually when I sit down to pray in the quiet of my home, this is a little different than when I'm in the car, and I do a lot of my praying in the car because I spend a lot of time on the road. But I find that what comes up first is a hymn of some sort or some kind of song that expresses my heart towards the Lord. Jesus, Jesus, how I love you, how I need you more and more, something like that. So I could just sing that as a prayer to introduce my time with the Lord. And then I if I have something more that I want to say, I say it. And when I run out of things that I'm just naturally, in a certain sense, overflowing with, that just coming naturally out of my heart, then I pick up the Word and I start to read. And I might read the Puritan Prayer Book, Valley of Vision. I usually often will read one entry because that's a prayer of a Puritan, and that helps to get me going. Or I might just go back to the Psalms, and lately I've been reading Psalm 51 on a regular basis. I almost have it memorized because this prayer of contrition and confession by David himself. And it's a wonderful passage to kind of set my heart right before God. And there are other psalms that can do that too. There are times, though, when I just feel like I'm flowing and it just comes naturally. I don't need anything to kind of get me going in a genuine, heartfelt connection with God. And then I'll just pray until I'm done praying, and then I'll go to the Word. So for me, there's certainly a connection, a relationship between my prayer time and the Word if I'm not driving. Obviously, I can't read the Bible when I'm driving and praying. But I try to redeem my driving time for time of intimacy with the Lord, and I ask God for care for my family, a daily enterprise, and my wife, my daughters, my daily schedule. But I want my own mind to be tutored by the truth of the Word. And so the Word plays a very important part there. All right, friends, that's it for this hour. Thanks so much for joining me. I'm Greg Kokel from Stand to Reason. Give them heaven. All right, friends, bye-bye now.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.